My name is Carl. I'm an alcoholic. So, yeah, I'm grateful to be here today. Nice to see a lot of new faces for me. The only person I know here is Chris. So, I'd be lying if I said I wasn't a little nervous. But bear with me. So, I guess we can start at the beginning. I was born and raised in Mexico City. My childhood was pretty normal. My dad was pretty absent. My mom was pretty loving. I remember, on the average, I thought my childhood was the same as anybody else's. But I do remember feeling like an outsider everywhere I went. I remember feeling like I was outside of an inside joke. In the neighborhood where I was growing up, I remember trying to be friends with the neighbors and always feeling like they were more friends with each other than they were with me. At one point, one of the neighborhood kids beat me up. So I always felt like I didn't really belong in one particular place. I remember my first drink was maybe 11 or 12 years old. There was a function at home. I think it was Easter. My dad let me have a little bit of wine. I drank it, and I really liked it. It was a lot of fun. I remember getting really silly and laughing a lot. I thought it was a lot of fun. I didn't give it much thought after that. I didn't really feel like I needed to have it again, at least not at that time. Early teenage years, I went without any alcohol. It was fine. I went to high school at a boarding school that was all men in Canada, and I didn't have access to alcohol. So the last 2 years of high school, I was pretty much an A student. I didn't have any distractions, no women, no alcohol, no drugs, no nothing, so might as well study. So I graduated with honors. It was all really cool. And then I went to college here at UT, and things changed. I was 18 when I came to the States, and at that time, 18 was the legal age to drink. So I never really drank illegally. But I started drinking in college, and I started drinking as all my friends did. We'd go to parties, keg parties. I felt like I was doing what everybody else was doing. Didn't really feel out of the ordinary for me. I do remember paying very little attention to the problems that were kind of peaking in my drinking. There was one time where I used to go to, every Wednesday we used to go to Nasty's on Guadalupe. I don't know if it's still even there. But there's this little bar, and back then, they had pitchers margaritas, Everclear margaritas for like $1.50, something ridiculous, on Wednesday nights. So we'd always be there. We drank many times till I blacked out. And at that time, I was riding a motorcycle. One time, I went with a friend of mine, and he rode with me in the motorcycle. We didn't have helmets. And on the way back, I gave him a ride home, and I was plastered. I didn't even give it a second thought. I was so drunk. On the way back, at a stop sign, when we started off, it was a very small bike, so it didn't really have a lot of weight, and I had a guy behind me. So at a stop sign, I revved it up, and we pulled a wheelie, and we fell backwards. And the guy scraped his leg, and I had some bruises and whatnot, but we didn't even give it a second thought. I was driving wasted, carrying somebody else's in my motorcycle, and we had a wheelie, and the guy fell and scraped, and I didn't even think that there was anything wrong with that. We laughed it off, we got right back on the motorcycle, and we went home. That was the first of many little incidents in vehicles that I had throughout my life as an alcoholic. So that happened. No second thoughts on that. Didn't do anything wrong. It was just fun and games. I also, while I was in college, I started playing in bands. I'm a musician. So I was playing in bands, and, alcohol is abundant in the lifestyle. So I drank as much as my bandmates did. I didn't see anything wrong with it. And I remember one night, I had heard I heard a lot about cocaine and how dangerous it is and how you shouldn't really get into it. And I remember one night after a gig, we went into somebody's house. They invited us, and we went there, and I saw they had a mirror with some lines for everybody. And I figured I'd give it a try. I'd check it out. This was in my early 20s. And I tried it, and I loved it. It was awesome. I stayed up all night. We made plans. We were going to take over the world. It was incredible. And I woke up the next morning feeling really scared because I really, really liked it. So I swore I would never do it again. And I stayed away from it for a while. I also remember at one point I tried pot. The first time I tried pot, I loved it. It was so great. Everybody was my friend. I felt like I belonged. And I tried it again later, and the second time it didn't have the same effect. I just became really paranoid, really angsty, and I just realized that pot was not for me. But alcohol was great. I would never stop. That worked for me. It made me feel like I belonged. It made me feel like I was part of. It reduced all the inhibitions that I had. I could be myself when I drank. So it was my friend, and it worked. It was my solution. Whenever I needed to change the way I felt, alcohol was there for me. You know, work hard and play hard was my motto for many, many years, and that worked. You know, I had two different lives. I had my work life and my drinking life, and I had different sets of friends, my friends that were there when I was working, my friends that were there when I was drinking. And I never really thought anything of it. I didn't think there was anything wrong with it. I just felt like that's what a lot of people did. You know, we work, and then we go party. That's what we do. I was really conscious of trying to keep those worlds apart. And I was becoming successful in what I was doing as a musician. I was writing music for commercials and doing that kind of thing, producing bands. And, I swore I would never, like, mix in the studio while drinking because I knew that it would affect my ability to do my job right. But sure enough, at one point I started feeling like, well, you know, a drink's not going to hurt. I've worked all day, might as well have a drink and keep working. And I thought I was doing an awesome job. And the next morning I would hear what I was doing, and it's like, you know, that mix sounds like shit. Sorry, kids. That mix is terrible. And sure enough, you know, my ears were getting very fatigued. When you drink, all your senses get numbed, including your hearing. And so everything, if you guys know anything about music and sound, you know, when your hearing is hampered, you want to turn the treble on everything. So all of my mixes were coming out really, really bright. It sounded very, very harsh and terrible. So I kind of learned a little bit from that. I stayed in control of that for a while. Let me see. I made some notes here. I'm not checking my Tinder. I'm looking at my notes. Another important factor here. I got married here in the States, and by virtue of doing that, I got a green card, a permanent resident card. So after a while, you know, when it was early 30s, I discovered cocaine again, and I felt like I was mature enough to handle it. So I tried it again. I tried it again, and I loved it again. And it was the kind of thing that I swore I would never carry with me. I thought, well, you know, if it's there when I show up, if it's there in the thing, well, I'll partake, right? But I won't seek it. But what ended up happening is that I would show up in the places that I knew would be there. So hey, it's here. Let's do a line. Sure, let's do it. And once I get started on that, anything goes. I was an equal opportunity drug taker. As soon as I have a few Bacardis in me, you know, where's the blow? And once I have some pot, it's like, what do you got? What's that pill? Well, sure, I'll take it. I would have anything that anybody would hand me. I just wanted to change the way I felt. And I remember always wanting to, I was always seeking for something. I was always feeling like I wasn't in the right place. I need to go someplace else. I need to find something else that would change the way I felt so that I could find the comfort, that Mecca that I was always looking for, that I would never find. And I felt like drugs would take me there, and they never did. I never arrived. I always woke up feeling like, you know, I didn't get what I needed. And the more alcohol and the more drugs I did, the more time passed, the worse I felt when I woke up in the morning. And all this time, I was driving home every time. Most of the times when I was out drinking, I would drive home drunk. A lot of times during a blackout. There were several little accidents. One time I remember when I was getting home, scraping the side of my car on my neighbor's mailbox. And the first thing that I thought was like, damn, I almost made it, you know? And I lied to the insurance company. I told them there was a deer and that I had to swerve, and that's why I had to scrape the neighbor's mailbox. And they paid for the mailbox, they paid for the repair, and I got away with it. So I didn't think anything of that. My wife at the time was a singer, and she had a happy hour gig every Friday. Started at 6. It was from 6 to 9 at the Lucky Lounge on 5th Street. Doesn't exist anymore, but it was there for a long time. And I would get there to help her set up. And I would show up at 5, and everybody there knew me, and they knew what I wanted to drink. And they always would give me a pint-sized glass of Bacardi and Coke, with about this much Bacardi and about this much Coke. They knew what, and it was free. So, great. Show up at 5, start drinking, no problem. By the time she finished, I was plastered at 9 o'clock. And then I went out to start partying. I also remember plenty of times I would drink before going out, so that when I showed up with my friends, I wouldn't have to drink so much in front of them. I'd already have a bus when I showed up, so I wouldn't have to, you know, get plastered in front of them or them thinking that I'm drinking too much. Which, you know, didn't fool anybody. So, let me see. Another time I was also driving this vehicle. And I, by the way, have a son. I have a son that's 19 now. But at the time, I got sober when he was about 8. So he was young at the time. And I never drove drunk with him, thank God. Because I'm sure that would have ended up being the case eventually. But another time I was driving a van. I was downtown after partying. I made a turn off of Congress into 5th Street, I think. And I hit the sidewalk so hard that the wheel blew up. And the tire blew up. And I was so pissed because all I wanted to do is just get home. And I parked there. I was calling a friend, trying to figure if they could take me home. I was kind of trying to figure out how to tell my wife, how to figure out maybe we can change the tire before, you know, she even finds out. And right when I was calling the guy, I was walking around my van. A cop comes up. And he asked me, he's like, is this your car? I was like, yes. And did that just happen? I said, yeah, I'm just trying to get my friend to come pick me up. I tried to act sober, but obviously he knew that I was drinking. He was like, you shouldn't get back in that car. He stayed with me until my friend picked me up. Thank God. I mean, he didn't take me in. He didn't see the accident. He didn't see me drive. So I guess legally he didn't have the right to arrest me at the time. But I got so another time that I got away with it. There was another incident, a couple other incidents like that. And then in 2001, I had a PI, my first PI. What happened is I was again at the Lucky Lounge, drinking like I always had. After my wife finished singing, I went next door to the bar next door. The Red Fest. It was the Red Fest at the time. I don't know if you guys ever went there. But it was owned by the same people, so I knew the owners, and I felt at home there. So I went in there. It was packed. I was wasted, and I went out to make a call, and then when I tried to get back in, the bouncer told me, it's like, you can't go in. You're too drunk. I'm like, well, what do you mean? Yeah, I was just inside. I was like, you can't go back in. You're too drunk. And I said, well, where's Lucky? That was the owner's name. He's like, Lucky's not here, and if you don't leave right now, I'm going to call the cops. And I said, well, call the effing cops. And I was thinking, just like, I just walk away, basically thinking to myself, don't you know who I think I am, right? And so he called the cops. He called the cops, and they must have been right on the corner because they showed up right away. And I'm like, I freaked out, and I went into the Lucky Lounge, and I told the guy that was managing, he's like, look, the cops are coming. Hide me, right? So he goes, well, go upstairs. And so I go upstairs, and I'm thinking, trying to figure out what to do. And remember, it's like, I have a friend that's a cop, so I'm going to call him. And so I call the cop. I was calling my friend, and he was still ringing, and the cops show up, and they tell me, put your phone down. And I'm like, wait, I'm calling one of you guys. And they're like, I'm not going to ask you again, put your phone down. And I go like this to the guy. And the next thing I know, I'm on the floor with getting handcuffed, being carried out the club. And I don't remember very much about what I said, but I know I was belligerent. I was screaming like, yeah, I think you feel so tough now that you get me hung down. You know, I was being an idiot. So I'm in the back of the police car, finally. I'm sitting there calming down, and the cop sits in the front, and he goes, why'd you have to fight? I just wanted to talk to you. And he goes, well, can't we just talk now? And I was like, no, it's too late. No, we're going in. And so I spent the weekend in jail. I got arrested for a PI and resisting arrest. So I had to do a year probation. And they told me, you shouldn't drink, you're not supposed to drink while you're on probation. And I thought, okay, cool, no problem. And within a month, I was drinking. I thought, it was like, everybody does it, right? They just say that, they don't really mean it. So I was drinking, and I didn't really even think about the consequences of what if I got caught, what that would mean. I didn't even consider that. I thought I was invincible. Well, around that time, a friend that I've known for many years asked me if I wanted to go to a meeting. And I didn't really know why he asked me. But I figured, sure, why not? Let's go check it out. And so I went to my first AA meeting, and this was in about 2001. And I remember kind of somebody talking. I didn't really pay attention to what they were saying. Talking about the Serenity Prayer. I saw the word God on the thing. I was like, it felt kind of iffy. And at the end, they asked about if anybody wanted the desire chip. I got a desire chip just because I felt like I was supposed to. And after the meeting, the chairperson comes to me and was like, welcome, you know you never have to drink again. And in my mind, I'm thinking, man, that sounds terrible. That's not for me. So I didn't go back. I went back to doing what I was doing. You know, I knew better. So I continued to live my life. Eventually, I got divorced, and the year that I got divorced was in the end of 2006. My son was about seven, and I remember thinking, I can be myself now. Finally, I don't have to respond to anybody. I dated this girl that was totally into drugs. It was an incredibly passionate relationship, very, very short-lived, basically like a ball of fire. We were doing drugs together. We were drinking. We were doing everything revolved around just getting high. She smoked hashish, and I'd never tried it, so I tried it, and I smoked with her. We both loved cocaine. She lived in Spain, thank God. So I'd go there for a couple of weeks. She'd come here for a couple of weeks. And it was insane. It was total insanity. And I thought that's what I wanted. I thought, this is it. This is what I've been missing all my years when I was married. This is what I didn't have. And when I found out that she was cheating on me, that she was doing all sorts of other things, I collapsed. It was like my whole world collapsed. And so I drank even more. And I kept seeking that mecca, that thing that I could never reach. I thought sex was going to do it, and it didn't. I thought alcohol would do it, but it never did. You know, it wasn't enough. And I always had to drink more and more and more and more. I was getting a lot of tolerance, and it got the time between drinking, the amount of alcohol, and getting to that point where I feel cool, and the blackout shortened. Because it's like, I would drink, I didn't feel it, it's like, oh, now I'm feeling it, now I'm blackout. So I remembered very little of a lot of those times. But the downs of the day after, the feeling of depression got worse and worse and worse and worse. I would wake up completely depressed, not wanting to get out of bed, swearing it off. If I had any blow left, I would toss it in the flush it down the toilet and swore I would never do it again. Only to 3 or 4 days later, it's like, hey, you know, I was just depressed. You know, I can totally do it. And I, you know, hey, where's the blow? Let's do it. Also, I kept crossing these lines. You know, I swore I would never carry it with me. I would just do it when it was there. And eventually I started carrying it with me. You know, when my friends had it, I was like, they give me a little baggie, I would take it. But then I swore I would never buy it. I would never pay for it. And sure enough, shortly after that, I started buying it, sometimes for my friends. And then I also swore I would never, you know, at least I don't have a dealer. Well, sure enough, eventually I had my own dealer and I got my own blow. And I was doing blow by myself. I felt really weird about that. I was like, I was getting to the point where I needed to do it just to feel straight. And that was scary. But I still felt like I had control. I had this delusion of control. There were times when I would think, it's like, well, I won't drink for this month just to prove to myself that I still have control. And within 2 weeks or 3 weeks, I'd say, okay, I've proven it. I can drink again. It's like, I basically felt that I was changing my mind, that I was choosing to drink again. I just couldn't make it to the month. I also remember many, many times I was trying to figure out how much I was drinking because I wasn't really paying attention. So I want more than once, maybe 3 or 4 times I tried this. I would start the night with a little napkin and writing little lines for every drink that I had, just a little line, 2, 3, 4. And I never finished those lists because I always forgot that I was doing a list. You know, I woke up, I was like, what happened? I could never remember how much I drank. Around that time, in 2007, I started. I figured it'd probably be a good idea for me to get my citizenship. I've been living in the States long enough, and I qualified to become a citizen, so I started applying for that. And I had an immigration attorney that was helping me with the process. It's a long process; it takes several months to do it, and. This is the year after my divorce, and right around, actually exactly on July 7th of 2007, we had a party. I went to a party that was called the 777 party, you know, July 7th, 2007. And it was a night that I wasn't planning on doing drugs. I was just planning on going, having a good time with my friends. And I showed up, I started drinking, and somebody showed up with a little blow. I was like, what the hell, I'll do something. And next thing I know, we go to the after party, somebody's house that I'd never met. We went to this guy's apartment, and we partied till dawn. And I did all sorts of other things. I think there was some pot, and somebody handed me, I don't know if it was ecstasy or something, but it was not unlike many other nights. I remember getting in my car about 7:30 in the morning. This was a Sunday morning. And my apartment was about 5 minutes from where this guy lived. So I got in the car, I started driving, and then the next thing I know, I come to in a spinning vehicle with the airbags deployed. And I don't know what the hell's going on. I'm like, what the hell? And I end up in a ditch. It's like I'm in a riot, you know, like I'm not even there. So I end up in this ditch, and I remember just being annoyed because I just wanted to be home asleep, you know? And I try to start the car. And it won't go. I'm like, I'm just pissed. And I see a guy driving, and he stops in front of me, and he's like really worried with a really big eyes. You know, he tells me, "Man, are you okay?" And I'm like, "Yeah, I'm fine." He goes, "Well, you know your wheel's over there." I'm like, "What?" And so eventually it occurred to me it was probably a good idea for me to get out of the car and look and see what happened. So I get out of the car, and I stumble on the side, and I realize that I was driving a four-door. The whole backside of my car from the back door to all the way to the back was completely caved in. There's no wheel. There's no tire. The wheel well is empty. And I realized, well, shit, something happened. And then I look over to the side, and I see around the corner an ambulance. And I'm like, what the hell? And they're stopping next to another car. And I'm trying to, and I see a sheriff walking towards me. And like trying to figure out, what am I going to say, trying to make up a story, you know. He asked me, well, have you been drinking? It's like, well, yeah, I had a couple of beers. I didn't know if it was day or night, you know. For me, it was still the night, you know. So I said, I had a couple of beers tonight, and it was Sunday morning. And it was already about 9:30, so I had been driving for a couple of hours in a blackout trying to get home, and it was somewhere on the way to Kyle on Highway 150. I have no idea how I got there. And I remember from my PI to be respectful to the cops. So I did whatever he asked. He was like, well, we're going to have to give you a breathalyzer test. And I said, yes, let's do it. And he took me in. We were going to do the test at Hays County. And as we're driving, we pass the ambulance in the other car, and I see somebody being wheeled into the ambulance. And then I went like this, ooh, I hope they're going to be okay. And the guy goes, yeah, I think she'll be fine. She just broke her arm. I'm like, wow, okay. So I'm taken to the station. I get a breathalyzer test, and I blew, I think, at 1.8, something like that. And remind you, this is already like 10 o'clock in the morning. So I still had more than twice the legal limit after several hours. So I spent the night in jail again, and I swore at that point, because I hurt somebody and we had that accident, that I would never drink and drive again. I was not going to swear off drinking, because that's too much of a part of my life, but I was not going to drink and drive again. And so, you know, I get a, at that point, I'm charged with a DWI. And I eventually get home. I try to manipulate my ex-wife to help me rent the car, and she says a word that says, enabling. And then, enabling, you know, she didn't want to help me anymore. And I'm like, that was really weird that she didn't want to help me. I was pissed at her. So I try to figure it out. A friend of mine helps me. Somehow I end up going to the dealer, and I get another car, lease, you know, fake my way through it. And within 2 months, I'm drinking and driving again. I'm thinking, well, it's just a couple of years. It's okay. And my DWI attorney keeps telling me, well, your court date keeps getting pushed back. So I'm thinking, in the back of my head, it's like, well, they're pushing it back because it's not important. It's no. This was years after. She asked if I was still in probation. This was years after. I had already finished my probation, so this was a fresh new start. Good question. I never got caught drinking when I was in probation. So I was lucky because I was drinking almost every day. But anyway, my DWI case kept getting pushed. And I'm thinking in the back of my head, it's like, well, they're probably pushing it because it's not important at all. They just have other things that are more important. So I'm starting to get cocky and thinking that, oh, I'm going to coast through this. And I also talked to my immigration attorney, and I tell him what's going on. And he goes like, well, you got to really try to get this dismissed, because if you get the DOAI, we're going to have to wait 5 years before we can apply for citizenship again. And so I'm like thinking, it's like, oh, this is going to be great. We're going to dismiss this. Everything's going to be cool. And, by the, you know, 3-4 months after the accident, I'm already back to the exact same thing that I was doing before. Drugs, drinking, driving, no problem. Then in January of 2008, I remember going to drink on a Saturday night, and nothing eventful. I don't think I did any drugs on there, but I must have eaten something that really, really didn't sit well with me, because I started throwing up. I had diarrhea. I could not keep anything in. For like 2 or 3 days, I could not keep anything in. By the time it was Tuesday, we were supposed to go to court the next day, and I'm feeling sick. I'm feeling terrible. And I call my attorney, and I ask him, so are we going to go to court tomorrow? And he says, well, you know, I didn't want to tell you, but the reason why they keep pushing your case is because they're moving it to felony court. And I'm like, what? He's like, yeah, you're going to get indicted for intoxication assault and aggravated assault with a deadly weapon. And I was like, what? I mean, those words, I'd never heard those before, and it sounded really, really scary. So I hung up, and I got really anxious, and I called my immigration attorney. And I tell him, it's like, I explained to him what's going on, and he goes, man, if anybody owes you any favors, right now is the time to cash it, because if you get convicted of either of those two charges, they're going to deport you out of the country, and they'll never let you back. And I'm like, but I have a son here. I was like, they don't care about that. And I'm like, but I've been here for over 20 years. Like, they don't care about that, you know? And that scared the shit out of me. I was very malnourished. I hadn't eaten for 3 days. I was broke. I was scared. And right at that moment when I hung up, I literally collapsed to my knees and I started bawling. And I remember just in a torrent of tears falling on the carpet, you know, just completely feeling helpless. And I just said, God, please help me. And that's what I feel like is considered the turning point for me. I didn't know what to do. I was broke. And I called. The first person that I thought to call was a therapist that I had worked with in the past. And I called her and I said, you know, I really need help. I don't have any money, but I'm desperate. And she said, don't worry about the money. Come tomorrow. She saw me for 8 months without charging me a penny. And that was the first of many, many people that selflessly gave to me and helped me when I felt like I deserved the least. So I was scared, and I called my criminal attorney, my DWI attorney, and I said, well, what are we going to do? And he goes, well, this is a felony case now, and so it's going to cost you a lot more. It's going to be $14,000, and you got to pay me now. And I was broke. I was like, you can't do this. I was going to get indicted, and which means I was going to be in jail. And if I didn't have any bail money, I didn't know how to get out of that. Well, so I called another friend of mine saying, you know, I really need help. I mean, it's the first time that I started talking to other people about what I was doing and what had happened. I didn't have the courage to let people know all the details, but I did say that I was drinking and driving and that I hurt somebody else. And a friend suggested that I call a particular attorney, and I called this attorney, and he seemed like he really knew what he was talking about. But he says, well, you know, it looks like we're going to have to go to court. Because, you know, the mother of the person that you hit is an attorney, and she's pressing charges. And the lady that I hurt was a rowing student, and she was 19 years old. So, but even though she's an adult, she was still living at home. And so I basically ruined her athletic career, at least temporarily. So things were getting bad quick. And as part of the DWI case that I had, I was supposed to go to a DWI class. And so I went to this class and I talked to the guy. I tried to save face. I tried to show up like, oh, and by the way, when I got that call on that Tuesday, I decided I would never drink again. That's when I made the decision not to drink again. And I just went cold turkey. I went by myself. I didn't think about AA. I didn't think about going to any kind of groups. And I stayed like that for 3 months. I can honestly say that those were the three most miserable, most lonely months that I've ever had to survive. Because everybody that I knew drank as much as I did. And I had surrounded myself with people that were just as alcoholic as I was. I didn't know anybody that didn't drink. My family didn't live in town, doesn't live in town. And I didn't know where to turn, so I cocooned myself in the apartment. And it was very, very scary. I knew that I didn't want to drink anymore, but I could not imagine life without alcohol or drugs. So anyway, back to the DWI class. I go to this class, and the teacher is an older gentleman, very nice guy. It's a week-long course, and at the end of the course, he calls me in private. He gives me an exit interview. He saw something special in me. And so he says, well, you know, so how are you going to prevent from, how are you going to stop from drinking and driving? How are you going to prevent from doing that? And I told him, well, I'm just not going to drink again. He goes, okay, but what happens if you start? I didn't understand the question. It's like, I'm just not going to do it. I'm not going to start. I'm going to stay. You know, how are you going to achieve that? And I didn't really get the gist of what he was talking about. He didn't say that I was an alcoholic. He didn't force me to do anything. But what he said is like, well, why don't you try AA? I'm like, AA? He goes like, well, yeah. You know, he didn't force me. It was in court order or anything like that. He's like, you know, you might want to check it out. There's a lot of people that aren't drinking there. And that's what I thought. It's like, well, you know, I gave it a thought, and I'm really grateful that he didn't force me, because it would have been a very different experience. But I gave it a thought, and after a week I thought, well, I'll give it a try, because I wanted to be surrounded with people who weren't drinking. And so I went to my first meeting. Luckily, a friend of mine also had a DWI, and she was forced by her court to go to AA, so we went as AA buddies. And the gentleman that gave me the exit interview said, maybe you try 2-3 times a week, check it out. And I thought, it's like, man, 2-3 times a week, that's too much. I'm too busy. I don't have time for that. Well, I started going, and I was very skeptical. You know, I saw the word God on the wall, and I was like, man, the word God had carried a lot of baggage for me. But the little thing that saved me is like, as we understood him, that little line on the third step, as we understood him, just opened enough of a crack for me to realize that, well, maybe I can interpret my own way into this. And it took about a month before I started seeing the similarities and not the differences. And it took me about a month to actually say out loud that I was an alcoholic. During that period, before I admitted it, when I spoke, I would say, my name is Carl, and I'm here to find out. That's how I introduced myself at first. Once I admitted that I was an alcoholic, I was afraid. You know, I was afraid to admit it, because once the cat's out of the bag, you can't put it back in. So once I realized that I had a lot more in common with the people in the rooms than I originally thought, I realized that, yeah, I belong here. And I asked the guy to sponsor me. I was desperate. I was really, really desperate. I really wanted to get this, because I had so much on the line. The prospect of losing contact with my son was catastrophic for me. So I had a very big incentive to do this right. And so I committed to doing everything that I was asked. I committed to doing it, to do everything by the book, so that if it didn't work, I knew it wasn't because I didn't try. And so I did what my sponsor asked me. I got numbers from different guys. I called him every day. I called the guys every day. I went to meetings. That summer I ended up going to about 2 or 3 meetings a day. And that's what I needed at the beginning. So I immersed myself in AA. And, you know, lo and behold, it started working. In the back of my mind, I had this thought. It's like, well, you know, if I make it to a year, I can prove to myself that I don't have a problem and I can drink again. But by virtue of doing the work, by the time I got to the year, I didn't really want to drink anymore. It's like, why would I trade what AA has given me for alcohol? And what I found out when I started doing the work, and when I, you know, after doing my fourth step and my fifth step and doing my amends and starting doing the 10th and 11th step, I realized that what AA was giving me was that thing that I was seeking for all those years with alcohol that I never got from alcohol or drugs. So I was able to find that comfort, that peace, that serenity, that was the thing that I never got from everything else. And so I realized that this was the thing that I always wanted. Today, you know, my sponsor in the very beginning asked me, well, go ahead and you need to pray every day. Pray in the morning every day. And so that's the one thing that I've done consistently for the last 10 years. Every morning when I wake up, I pray. The first words out of my mouth are, thank you, God. The last thing I say before I go to sleep is, thank you, God. My prayers in the morning have the shape of, I start with a gratitude list. Certain things that are given, and then certain things that are within my experience, my recent experience. I then ask for people that need help. If I know somebody who's needing help, I ask for help for them. And then I ask for guidance throughout the day to give me the intuitive thoughts to do the right thing, to do His will. I also go to meetings often. I go to about two meetings a week. Sometimes my work prevents me from going to as many meetings as I'd like to. In those times, I stay much closer in touch with my sponsor. I have sponsees. I try to invite God into everything I do. The 11th step is crucial for me. Pausing when agitated or doubtful. Asking for guidance throughout the day. Whenever I go to an important job, or if we're going to meet somebody who I respect that I need to, that I feel like I'm nervous about it, I try to pause before I enter the room and ask for guidance, invite God into that conversation. And sometimes it works better than others, and sometimes I mess up, but thank goodness there's ways to fix that through the steps. You know, the 10th step gives us the opportunity to make amends whenever we do wrong. You know, I've been sober for a little over 10 years now, and there's been periods of time when I've been deeper into the program, and periods of time when I've just kind of been skimming it. There's times when I meditate every day. There's times when I don't meditate every day. There's times when I only go to a meeting. There's been periods of time when I only go to a meeting every couple of weeks. And I can tell you that life is better when I do the work. I've had that experience. And I remember maybe it was about 6 years into it, then I started thinking, it's like, man, there's only 12 steps. How many meetings can I go to? It's like, I've already heard everything that has to be said about the fifth step. Everything has to be said about the seventh step. Everything, you know, it's like, there's only 12. I've already heard it all. But what I realize now is that I need to hear that, because I forget. It's very easy for me to forget. If I don't go on a regular basis, incorporate it as a daily practice and making it the basis for the way that I live my life, then shit goes bad pretty quick. And so I've had that experience, and that's wonderful. Just recently, I had a knee surgery about a month ago. And I was a little concerned because, you know, I hadn't had pain pills in a long time. And so I called my sponsor and I asked him, you know, how should I handle this? You know, I'm going to have surgery and they'll probably send me home with pain pills. And he had a great suggestion. It's like, well, have the doctor give you just 2 days worth and, you know, have a piece of paper and, you know, make sure you write down every time you take one. And don't wait until the exact time that it's given on the prescription for the next dose to take it, so that when you're finished, you'll have a record to prove yourself that you didn't relapse, that you followed direction. I said, well, that's great advice. Okay, awesome. So I go have the knee surgery. And I go through the process. You know, I have my little notepad ready, and I get home, and I'm here with a prescription, and I have no pain. I don't feel anything, and I'm like, well, fuck. You know, I was so, I mean, you know, I thought I was going to get a free ride. I thought I was going to get to have a little bit of taste of something. And it didn't happen. And I texted my sponsor, like, hey, no pain. I was like, great. You know, keep me updated. And so, you know, I knew better. But it just shows that I still have the same issues. I'm still an alcoholic. That hasn't gone away. You know, another thing that was interesting, you know, I recuperated very quickly. You know, within 4 days, I was walking around, and I didn't have any pain throughout the period. And, you know, the little bottle of pills was still sitting there. You know, and I was walking by it. It's like, I should probably throw this away. I was like, yeah, I should. Then next day, I would walk by them again. It's like, yeah, you probably need to throw this away. Yeah, walk away. Well, after a week, I finally decided, you know what? Today, you need to throw them away. So I did. I threw them away. But, you know, it's like, why did it take me a week to throw them away? It's like, am I going to have pain? You know, I was kind of maybe hoping. It's like, well, how much pain is enough? You know, it's just the alcoholic mind. A lot of weird thoughts cross through this head. But what the program has given me is the ability to distinguish the crazy thoughts, sort the crazy thoughts from the healthy thoughts. And those healthy thoughts, the intuitive thought, higher power, the higher self, the power of the universe, whatever you want to call it, is what the program gives me. It gives me the ability to do the right thing even when I don't feel like doing it. A big part of what I do every morning is I ask God for the guidance to show up as an honest, courageous, caring, considerate, mindful, and realistic man of faith. If I encounter a challenge or something that I don't know what to do exactly, I ask myself, what would an honest, courageous, caring, considerate, mindful, and realistic man of faith do in this situation? And usually I can answer that question, even though I don't feel like that's what I would want to do. But if I say, well, a person like that would do this, and if I try to do that, then usually my experience comes out better. And that has been my guiding process throughout the years. I don't do it perfectly. Many times I screw up, but we have, like I said, the tools to fix those moments when things don't go right. I do get irritable and discontent if I'm not working a program, and I have that experience too, and that's healthy as well, because I know that I can get in that mind space if I don't do this right. And I've lived a lot of life in the last 10 years. And, you know, some of it's been great. Some of it's really painful and challenging. And you know, I can go through pain, emotional pain and physical pain, without having to drink or drug. I can still be at peace in pain. And the peace is what this program gives me, that serenity that the promises give us. It does work if you do it. And I'm so grateful to have been here. Thank you guys for having me today. It's been wonderful to be here. I appreciate you. Thank you.